More years ago than I care to remember, I set myself the problem of trying to understand phase transitions in the early universe, or at least in an expanding universe, and I've nibbled away at it for quite some time. If I'd known how many problems I was going to come up against, then I would probably have stopped on the second day, and I've been doing it more or less in isolation from what pretty much everyone else has been thinking about, so you'll get my view of what it is. So first of all, I'll tell you what the problem was that I set out to solve, which is pretty much the same problem that other people have been thinking about. Then I'll tell you about some of the problems that I came up against in my way of looking at it, and you'll get my way of looking at it. And to tell you the bottom line is that after I won't tell you how many years. What I think I can do is to more or less write down a set of Feynman rules which I might be able to use to do the calculations that I would like to do. Okay. So that's where I've got to. Let me tell you how I've got there. So I wanted to start by looking at the very simplest problem that I could think of. And so I thought about a scalar field theory which in Minkowski space would have this Lagrangian density, and the mass squared parameter that I put in there is positive, so with the sign that I've got in there, that means that at zero temperature in Minkowski space the symmetry would be spontaneously broken. And what I'd like to be able to do in an expanding universe is to solve the Einstein equations. The semi-classical Einstein equations, that is to say, where I need to take the expectation value of the stress tensor on the right-hand side, and what I've been trying to figure out is what is a sensible way to calculate the expectation value of this stress tensor, and I decided that I was going to use perturbation theory to do it, because I was thinking of a theory with one field, not a theory with several million fields in it, and perturbation theory was the only way that I could at the time of trying to do that. And so I wanted to make things as simple for myself as possible, so I've taken a Robertson-Walker space-time, and I've used a conformal time coordinate, and if you do that, and if you rescale field appropriately, and I've taken a conformally coupled field, and then the problem that you get is essentially equivalent to a Minkowski space field theory, but with a time-dependent mass, and if it wasn't conformally coupled, then you would just get a somewhat more complicated expression for the time-dependent mass. So what's the problem that I want to solve? I want to take an initial density matrix corresponding to, let's say, a thermal distribution at some temperature that is high enough for the symmetry to be restored, and then I want to see what happens after that. Okay. And so what I'm going to talk about is, well, that the expectation value here is the trace of rho times whatever expectation value I want to take, and the question is, how do I set about calculating that? Maybe it's worth just pointing a couple of things out about this model that I started with. If I write down a generally covariant action, then it looks like this. And in order to get the theory in the form that I'm going to use it, the transformation that I've made is that my original phi that I call the capital phi is 1 over the scale factor times the phi that I'm going to use. Now the effect of that is that if I think in terms of an effective potential, which in the end I'm not going to do because I don't think that it's really a useful dynamical tool, what you might imagine on the basis of just doing finite temperature field theory is that I have an effective mass which is some constant times my initial temperature squared minus well, something that is proportional to a squared of t. So this is becoming negative. The temperature is fixed its initial value, if you like. It's a conformal temperature. It's conjugate to the Hamiltonian that generates translations in conformal time. And so the effective potential is not something which is going to approach some fixed potential at low temperatures. It's something where the minima are going to go outwards forever as long as the universe is expanding. Okay. And that's because of this factor of a to the minus 1 in the redefinition of the field. Okay. So the basic formalism that's available for doing this is the closed time path formalism, which I won't go through in much detail because I guess most people know about it. The propagators for this theory that I'm going to need to do perturbation theory, or let's think indeed about the full two-point functions, there's a 3x3 matrix of them because the time path has a collection of three segments, two real-time segments and the imaginary time one, which represents the initial density matrix. I'm going to be particularly concerned with the real-time two-point functions, not because the other ones aren't there, but because they're the ones that I think have to think carefully about to how I'm going to deal with them. And so the real-time two-point functions make a 2x2 matrix, and the full two-point functions then are the expectation values of products of fields with different time orderings. Okay, now from the fact that my density matrix is Hermitian and the fact that I'm dealing with a Hermitian field, and I know that, that all of these four elements I can describe in terms of a single complex function, and I get, the complex conjugate of this function times theta of t minus t prime and the function itself times theta of t prime minus t. And so if I want to know what all these real-time propagators are, what I have to produce for you is a single complex function from which you can construct those two-point functions. And furthermore, I'm dealing with a spatially homogeneous system, not because the universe is spatially homogeneous, but because it makes it easier for me to do things. And so I'm usually going to take Fourier transforms and just express these functions as functions of time and a wave vector. It says here that I'm usually going to suppress these things. I fancy that when I actually wrote them out, I put the momenta in after all. Okay. So now the question is, how can we set up a perturbation theory based on this to calculate the expectation values that I'm interested in? And in general, if I want to do perturbation theory, the way that I do this is to split my action into an unperturbed part, my action into an unperturbed part and an interacting part. The interacting part, I extract that from my generating functional by taking derivatives with respect to a source, and I've got something left over here, and of course this factor here gives me vertices and this factor gives me propagators. Okay. And if I if I do things in the usual way, then the z-naught is just the exponential of this thing, which I hope the notation is clear. So if I do that, well, I get some I get a set of propagators, which I'm going to call the little g's. They're my lowest order approximation to the full two-point functions. And of course, I'm going to expect that I can write those down in the same form in which I write down the full two-point functions. And what I want is that that these propagators here should satisfy differential equation of the sort that I've got here, and the curly D here is a 2x2 matrix of differential operators that I get by writing the action in that way. Mm. So the simple thing to do is I say that S naught, my unperturbed action, is just the quadratic part of the one that I started with, and the interactions are the rest of it. And in that case, it's a simple matter to write down what this differential operator is. It has these familiar terms in the diagonal elements, and it has zeros everywhere else. And then you can solve this equation reasonably straightforwardly. And I just have to tell you what that one function, little hk of t and t prime is. Well, I can write it down in terms of mode functions which satisfy this homogeneous equation, and constants, which in finite temperature field theory would just be the Bose-Einstein occupation numbers. This m squared, that, yes, it's mass squared. It doesn't depend on the field. It's just the one that I had in my action.
Okay.
I mean, it's m naught squared times a squared of t with conformal coupling. Okay. Okay. And these mode functions have to satisfy the Wronskian condition. Well, that's not such a good idea. Why isn't it a good idea? First of all, well, what I've got there, you would usually see a mass is minus m squared, which is negative, and so the propagators that you want to use are unstable. Okay, I mean, they're not sensibly defined. I can't, in that way, describe the symmetrical initial state that I want to start off with. Okay. And furthermore, the occupation numbers that I've got here, well, they will be presumably a Bose-Einstein distribution that comes from my initial density matrix, but they're fixed at the values that they have at t equals zero. And if I've got an interacting theory, then I would expect that these occupation numbers, if I describe the theory in a sensible way, ought to change with time, because the state of the system evolves with time, and these occupation numbers ought to evolve in consequence. And so, what is it that I really want to do? If I want a sensible perturbation theory, it seems to me that I need to take the state that I've got at some particular time, and I want to be able to describe that state in terms of the quasi-particle excitations of the state that I have at that time. Okay. And so, in particular, I would like to see a mass, let's say a mu squared of t, which is not just the mass that comes in my action, but it's the quasi-particle mass. That's what I'd like to see in my propagators. If I was more ambitious, I might not just want to have a quasi-particle mass, but I might want to some better estimate of what the actual dispersion relation is for the quasi-particle excitations. And again, I would like to see occupation numbers, which I expect to depend on time, which are the occupation numbers not for the modes that I get just by doing my Fourier transform or whatever, but I want at least in some approximation, I would like these to be occupation numbers for the actual quasi-particle excitations. So how can I try to do that? Well, of course, I can't do it exactly. What I have to do is to set up some kind of improved perturbation theory that I can actually try to work with. And so what I propose to do then is to make a somewhat more sophisticated choice of my lowest order action, which is to say, well, first of all, it has to be something that's quadratic, otherwise I don't know how to do the calculations. So I'll say it's the quadratic part of the action plus something else. And also, I want the something else to be local, because otherwise I don't really have a starting point that I can work with very easily. I mean, maybe I could improve on that, but at the moment I don't know how to do it. So the something else is going to be quadratic in these fields, And it's going to also be local. Yeah.
A and B are the closed time
path indices.
Is there any
yes.
Position dependence as well, or
NAB
is just a.
So MAB is a function of K, and it's also a function of T, and it's also a function of d by dt.
So.
Okay. Well, it'll become clear on the next line.
Okay. You said you're for the moment considering translation
and invariant
in space.
Translationally invariant in space.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's only a function of K, not K and
K. Yeah, that's right. Okay. So what can this be? I mean, it's a sort of generalized mass counter term, but it's going to have more than masses in it. I've got some equation numbers which I cross the board. I want my propagators that come out of this to have this form, because I know that the two-point functions, the full two-point functions, have this form. And so for the D, I want to choose something such that this equation here will admit a solution of that form. Okay, so I ask, what is the most general? What is the most general D that I could choose that would satisfy that? And that's equivalent to asking, what is the most general M? Okay, and it's not too difficult to figure that out. What I find is that the most general possible form of D, and these are this is again the real time parts of it. The most general form has, a dt squared there. It involves three unknown functions at the moment that I called alpha, beta and gamma. The beta is some generalization of m squared plus k squared. And the alpha and the gamma appear in these positions. Let me see. Yeah, now, I've only got two derivatives in the diagonal elements. I've got single derivatives in the off-diagonal elements, and that just comes from the fact that I have a delta function on the right-hand side of my equation. That has to come from differentiating theta functions, and the only way that can work out is if I have the second and first derivatives where I've put them. Okay? But so far, then, this beta k of t, the alpha, and the gamma of t are functions that I don't know. So I want to determine those in some way. And I suppose it's worth emphasising, since some referees have complained about this in the past. they could be for the moment. These things are not—they're not additions to the theory. Right? I mean, it's just a question of how I split up my action into two parts. Right? If I add the two bits together, then I get the action that I started off with. It's just a question of choosing what is the best lowest order theory to perturb about. Alpha, beta and gamma are all real. Okay. And that I means that that's the imaginary part. It'll come out.
Did you try to explain the logarithmic transform space or something like that?
No. Well, not explicitly. I mean, you might be able to look at it in that way, I don't know.
This is a transformation on Gaussian, because you're doing it at a quadratic order. So this should be equivalent to what we've seen several times in different notations. What Baumann talked about, what Christoph talked about, where he had three functions. You always, whenever you deal with Gaussian, you always have this structure. In addition to the mean field, which you're not describing, there are three other functions which preserve the canonical structure of Gaussian.
If you like, although you see the theory that's described by just by this S naught is not, as far as I know, unitary field theory. Because if I simply take the Hamiltonian, if I simply take the Hamiltonian for a field theory, what I get for this S is a sum of actions, right? It's an action of phi 1 plus S of phi 2 plus the Euclidean action of phi 3, which is a density matrix. Okay, this has some off-diagonal terms in it. Okay.
That's fine. It doesn't mean it's not unitary.
Well, what it means is that
alpha there is an exponent term.
Yeah.
Look at the equation of action. That's one element of
magnitude. That's a quadratic thing. So this is just free theory with a variational parameter.
Yeah, but yeah. What I'm saying is that if I start with a free field theory, okay, with a Hamiltonian that's made up of phis and pi's, I write down the path integral representation for this generating functional. I will only get things that are diagonal in this CTP index space. Okay, I will not get these off-diagonal terms.
Well, there's a different formula, so we have to really sit down here. But I believe that, for example, what we did, in which you have both Lyapunov transformations and off-diagonal terms, is completely equivalent to lowest order perturbation theory to this. But let me say what I think.
It is more or less the same as the kind of thing that Baylock was telling us about, where you work out the influence functional by integrating some stuff out. And if you integrate some stuff out, some other fields, which I'm not doing, then you get the same structure. That's what I'm.
You just said you haven't integrated.
I haven't integrated
anything that's really dissipated. Again, this question: what's really dissipated?
Sure. Okay, so how am I going to choose these functions that are so far arbitrary? Well, what I would like to do then, order by order in perturbation theory, if you like, is to work out the full two-point function. And if I do that, then I have my lowest order propagators plus the familiar set of loop diagrams. So I have a counter term corresponding to the M that I introduced. And in some way, I would like to organize things so that this whole collection of terms is as small as possible. I mean, that's the basic idea. Now, clearly, I cannot set this exactly equal to zero because this guy is local and this is non-local. And so the best thing that I can do is to choose some renormalization point and ask that this vanishes at that point. Okay. Just to make things simple, I'm going to require that the beta of k, I'm just going to take it to be k squared plus some quasi-particle mass squared. That's just because it makes things simple for me. I think if one works hard enough, you can probably do better than that. And then gamma turns out, when you do this, to be a quasi-particle damping rate. And you can see that if I now write down the function h that I'm going to construct my propagators from, I get an exponential factor which is damped. It goes to zero at large time separations. Okay. So you are basically seeing damped quasi-particle modes. I could have kept this inside the mode functions, but I've just extracted it because then it looks a bit easier. Inside here, where I had before the fixed Bose-Einstein occupation numbers, I now have some functions that I've called n of t, and this is n star of well, t prime, in fact. The time dependence here is only on one of these time arguments, and when I put it into the propagator, this time argument is always the earlier one. Okay. So here is what happens schematically. I've got another couple of slides where I may show you some details if you're interested. But now, the mode functions satisfy this new equation where, instead of the m squared of t that I had before, which was negative, I now have this positive quasi-particle mass squared, and because I've got something like a damped harmonic oscillator, well, I've also got the square of the damping rate in there, which just shifts the mass a little bit. Okay? And these n's satisfy another second-order differential equation, which involves the alpha and the gamma, and the beta, I suppose. If you like, yeah, well, I'll show you it in a little bit more detail in a second. But to make sense of what this means, I can tell you that if I consider everything to be varying slowly enough so that I can neglect this second derivative, and then there's a first derivative in there as well, and if my coupling constant is small enough so that I only look at up to two loop diagrams, let's say, then I can approximately interpret this function n as being twice a time dependent Bose-Einstein occupation number plus one. What does this equation then look like? Well, after I've identified my alpha and my gamma using the prescription that I showed you, then that approximate equation becomes something which is a Boltzmann equation. Well, it isn't a full Boltzmann equation because I've only got time dependence, so there are no free streaming terms on the right hand side there. What is alpha turning out to be? Yeah. If I can find. Suppose I try to figure out a simple solution to my Boltzmann equation, which is that n of t is something like n equilibrium of t plus e to the minus gamma t n of 0 minus n equilibrium. Okay. Then this guy, this gamma is the one that I showed you. Alpha is basically that. That's roughly the way it works out if I try to fit the solution into this form. Okay. And so alpha is not alpha itself, but some combination of alpha and other stuff that I just can't remember off the top of my head, roughly represents this. So it's a sort of underlying equilibrium distribution that the field is trying to relax to, if you like. That's the best way I can say it. Okay. In here?
Yeah.
Okay.
Your,
it comes from my renormalization condition, and if I can find the appropriate transparency, which is just here, the alpha and the gamma are determined at lowest order by this diagram. Okay. In fact, by the absorptive part of this diagram, which means I have to cut it across the middle there, and then I'm dealing with two particle collisions. Okay. And that's just where these things come from. It's these tell me how many particles I've got in the final state, and these tell me how many particles I've got in the initial state. What I'm doing to get this is I'm saying First of all, in the real equation that I've got, as I said, I'm simply neglecting that time derivative. I'm not asking when it's valid. All I'm doing is trying to make contact with this. Okay. Yes. Right. Now I said that lambda is going to be small. Okay. Now gamma is a thing that's of order lambda squared. Okay. So this thing appears inside the propagators that are inside here. Okay. This thing is already multiplied by lambda squared out there. So inside that propagator, I will take gamma to zero, and then gamma is just the I epsilon, if you like, that comes in the Feynman propagator. Okay. Yeah. Well, plugging in and computing that diagram, but making approximations that are no longer putting the damping rate in there. I'm just taking that to zero.
And now you're choosing some point at which to apply your condition that's equivalent, that's something close to putting your fuzzy particles on that shell.
That's right. And so if I think about it in terms of, and I've got a self-energy which, if you like, depends on momentum and a time-dependent frequency. Okay. And so that I'm just saying that that time-dependent frequency is the nearest thing I can I can get to being on the shell, if you like.
So you've chosen to put things up so your, quote, bare propagators mm-hmm. are the best whole approximation to the true propagator.
Well, let me tell you, I'm doing two things. The first thing I'm doing is what you said, and that gives me these equations plus a way of determining what my undetermined functions were just by applying this condition. Okay. Now at that stage, and that's the way that I would like to compute, I have this full equation. Okay. Now I'm saying I will make some further approximations. I will only consider these diagrams. Inside the diagram, I'll take gamma to be very small. The reason I'm doing that is just to see that what I've got here does come out to be something like what I get from kinetic theory. If I make enough approximations, but I don't want to commit myself to making those approximations in general.
Now, are you concerned about the fact that in your dot, with your collision term?
Yeah.
I
mean, so in
essence, some place you have
in here.
Energy and momentum conserving delta function that's, you know, in
yes.
every collision term.
Yes.
But that now has your effective dispersion relation.
Yeah.
That the mass is changing in time.
Yeah.
Means if you have exactly what you've written and no additional terms,
uh-huh.
that Boltzmann equation does not satisfy conservation of the unit. Due to the mm-hmm. dependence of the effective mass.
The answer is yes, I am worried about it. I don't know how far I can go towards fixing that up because I haven't thought seriously about that.
Uh-huh.
Oh, well, that's good. In this equation, these are C numbers.
So it worries me. I said that expression is zero.
Different K.
This.
Different K.
I'm sorry. I mean this. What one of these ends has this K, and the other ends have K's that I'm integrating over. And if I wrote it all down, it would have gone off the transparency.
And besides the assumption on gamma, there is an assumption of mu being slowly varying or something.
And what?
Yeah.
Okay.
And what I mean by that is that if I want to get out this approximation to what I had, I have to neglect the second time derivative. Okay. So I'm not necessarily telling you that even if the time evolution is slow enough, I'm really entitled to do that. All I'm doing is telling you that that if I do that, this is what I get out, and so I can see that there's something moderately sensible coming out. That's
if we follow Emil's earlier remark that the starting point is basically the same, can we understand what this statement means here?
I think an interesting
well.
don't bring up the keyword.
Can you hold that thought for a discussion?
I don't think you want to go down that path.
Well,
this is not
a
Gaussian approximation of unitary time equation.
That's correct.
By choice, this is taking a Hermitian Hamiltonian and splitting it into two non-Hermitian pieces.
It's not even doing that. even if I took a non-Hermitian part of the Hamiltonian, I still would not get these off-diagonal terms in the closed time path action. Okay, so it's not something that you could do at the operator level in any way that I know. It's a way of trying to approximate the functional integral. Okay, but the way I want to look at this, just qualitatively, is that when I get my propagators to start with, I'm dealing with each mode independently. Okay. Now I've got a self-consistent scheme where I'm including in that part of the coupling of one mode to all the other modes. Okay. And so the way I would like to make the connection with your influence functional analyses is to think of this one mode that I'm getting the propagator for as being in an environment which is all the other modes. And I'm trying to do that sort of thing in a self-consistent way. I mean, those are the words that I use to myself. Okay? Yeah.
Nicholas, you have an MAD in the free part of the action and an MAD in the directing part of the action. And it seems to me that you're dealing with them in a different way. The MAD which goes into the free part then goes into the propagator and
yes.
uses one perturbativity.
Right.
You have something to work about it.
Well, it's the same thing that you would do when you do a mastery normalization. When you do a mastery normalization. Yeah? I say that I have a bare mass in my action, the mass that I'm going to use in my propagator is the one that locates the pole of the propagator, and so it's the bare mass plus an infinite sequence of terms. And then when I do my renormalized perturbation theory, I'm treating that renormalized mass as being of order 1 in the coupling constant rather than the bare mass. As being of order 1. No, it's zeroth order in the coupling, but it has other terms, if you like. I mean, it depends what you're going to say is of order lambda.
You can describe this as saying you're re-summing terms which would be secular terms, even if they're arbitrarily recoupling.
The variational.
No, it's
but these are variational parameters. Why not?
No, it's not variational, it's self-consistent.
That the mass normalization works, and that's how you specify these things, right?
It's not variational. Well, it's just the width of a Gaussian by adding and subtracting
and then equating that shift to what you get by simply calculating the shift.
Okay, but you know what is going on here is something else. It's just talking about some timescale separation, throwing out second derivative. That's something on my theory.
Oh well, that's for the purposes of illustration. That's not okay.
Okay.
Okay. So I've probably said enough about that. Just before I leave this bit, I want to tell you that once I've constructed my my big D, the operator that comes into the equation for the propagators, well, there is a little D operator associated with that, which is the thing that I've written down here. It's got the anti-symmetric time derivative in and the damping rate. Now, I've asked around because I feel that there must be a proper name for this little operator, but I don't know what it is. I mean, what it does is more or less well known, is that if I take two of these operators here and I sandwich them in with a D at some intermediate time, then I get a G at T and T prime if the intermediate time is in between these two, and otherwise I get zero. I got a plus sign or a minus sign. Does anybody know a name for that, for the operator that does that? Yeah, that's basically it. Yeah. Little g is my unperturbed propagator, my lowest order approximation to the two-point function. Okay. Except that it's a matrix. This is the 2x2 matrix of real-time functions. Okay. Anyway, so there is this little operator that does that, and I'm representing it diagrammatically by that. Okay. So that's at least at a formal level helps to solve the first set of difficulties that I started off with. Let me just point out that I've just shown you this for a single scalar field. I can do it for a complex scalar field with a non-zero chemical potential. It works out more or less the same way, except that there is a time-dependent frequency, if you like, an effective thermal mass for... well, there's one for particles and one for antiparticles, and they're different if the chemical potential is not zero. The relaxation rate and the occupation numbers are also different if the chemical potential is not equal to zero, obviously. Okay, so you can do it for complex scalar fields. You can also do it for Dirac spinners. You can go through basically the same procedure. Things work out rather more messily, which is why I haven't written anything down. And in fact, it's so messy that I have to go back to my student's thesis to remember what the results were. But one of these days I'm going to get round to writing up the paper on it, and then I still know what it is. But you can... No, I don't know what you mean.
If you're close to equilibrium and you just look at the dispersion relation of fermions at high temperature, and you get these two different branches, you get one branch that various people call the Piazzino, that energy as a function of momentum sort of goes down before it starts going up.
Yeah.
I mean, that was the motivation, but I mean, in essence, put in a small expansion rate, and then this formalism just looks like a slow variation of what would otherwise have been thermal equilibrium. So certainly, I have results which go over.
Oh, sure. Yeah, sure.
And so this is just a question of how much of the physics that we know is in the fermion self-energy in the thermal case. Is nicely getting packaged into your lowest order approximation.
I'm afraid I can't tell you that offhand. What I can tell you, though, is that if I go through the same approximations that gave me the Boltzmann equation for the scalar field, that doesn't work for the spinners. When I go through this same thing, I get a Boltzmann equation, but with some other terms that wouldn't be there. Well, I just haven't had a chance to try to figure out what that means. I don't know. So now I guess it occurred to me when I was looking at this that having heard Larry's talk earlier on, where you said that perturbation theory was only good for short times, and the comment that occurs to me is it depends how you do perturbation theory. Now, I don't know whether you had thought of folding this kind of thing in when you said that, or what. But I mean, if you want to go over to kinetic theory at later times, then I guess what I want to say is that if you do perturbation theory in the right way, you can fold that into perturbation theory.
Well, just for asking for a comment, I mean, I completely agree mm-hmm. that this way of doing things is putting essentially the physics of single particle excitations directly into your baropropagators. And that's very nice. That's a nice thing to do for lots of purposes. However, if you were interested in calculating something like a current-current correlation function or a cumulative correlation function, something where your perturbative approximation would be a one-loop graph,
mm-hmm.
at long time, in your scheme, including just that one-loop graph is not... is wrong for sufficiently large times.
Sure.
Understanding that physics,
yeah.
But not everything.
Okay.
Whereas if you look at essentially single quasi-particle propagation, then you've basically resummed everything that's important.
Well, I've resummed everything that I can. I'm not sure whether it's everything that's important. I mean, you get some approximation to it, and. Okay. One would also like, I guess, to do this for gauge fields. Presumably it can be done, but gauge fields have their own problems, and I haven't thought seriously about how that might affect it. Okay. So that's the first bunch of problems that I came across. Here's the second one. Which is that I'm starting in a high temperature initial state where the expectation value of my field is equal to zero. I'm involving it with a Hamiltonian which is symmetric. There is no way but that the expectation of phi will be equal to zero at all later times. Okay. So how can I deal with that? One way is to put in some symmetry breaking by hand, but I don't want to do that, and partly because the answer that I get out will depend on what I put in, and secondly because even if I do start in this symmetric state, then something must come out, and it would be nice to know what that is, if only because the symmetry that I'm thinking about notionally is the symmetry that's exact in nature, and there's no actual way that you can put in symmetry breaking. So the picture that I have then is that what is happening is something like this. I draw an conjectural effective potential, only to guide the eye, because I don't think the effective potential is a sensible dynamical tool to use, but you might imagine that there is some effective potential which is underlying the evolution, which starts off looking like this and ends up looking like that. And so if I think of just a quantum mechanical particle that moves in a potential that starts looking like that and finishes looking like that, well, it would have, let's say, a probability distribution which starts off looking like that and finishes up looking like that. Okay. And so what I would like to be able to do then is to describe a final state that looks something like that. Okay. The question is, how can you do that? The problem in doing that is that you need some lowest order Hamiltonian, if you like, or a lowest order action, which will describe the excitations of that state. And so let me first of all tell you how you can do that if you just think about it in Minkowski space-time. The standard way of dealing with symmetry breaking is you say the field has an expectation value which is sigma, And then it has a fluctuation psi, and this psi then is the operator that creates particles from the vacuum which has only one peak, from the asymmetrical vacuum. Okay. What I propose to do, and in fact what I have done, is not to give phi an expectation value, but to give phi squared an expectation value instead. Okay. So whereas according to the conventional picture, I would have that phi squared was sigma squared plus 2 sigma psi plus psi squared, now I'm saying that phi squared is the expectation value of phi squared plus, well, twice that square root of that expectation value times another field that I call zeta. And I just make that transformation in my action, and I'm not thinking about the closed time path for the moment. I'm just thinking about Minkowski space, or perhaps Euclidean space. Okay. What do you get? Well, where I had phi to the fourth, you see, I get something that's has zeta squared in it. Where I had phi squared, I get something that's just linear in zeta. All of the interactions now come in this kinetic term, okay, which is d mu zeta d mu zeta divided by 1 plus 2 over u times zeta. It's the way that it works out. There's also a Jacobian in there, which is important, but I haven't actually shown it to you.
It's not that you define an auxiliary field that will be phi squared, but you just took the square root of that equation and substituted that into the action.
It's not quite taking the square root. I mean, if I differentiate this, then I get that 2 phi times the derivative of phi is the derivative of this. Okay. I just said there is a Jacobian and that gives you a contribution on the end of here. Let me just tell you what that Jacobian does. It has a delta of zero in front of it. Now in here you've got derivative interactions, and that gives you extra quartic divergences in your Feynman diagrams, and this delta zero cancels out some of those quartic divergences, and that's what helps to make it renormalizable. Okay, so that's what the Jacobian does for you. So now if I look at the term that's linear in zeta here, what I want, of course, is to say that I want to fix up this expectation value here in such a way that the expectation value of zeta is zero. So to lowest order, that means that that this factor here has to vanish, and that tells me that the u squared goes like m squared divided by lambda. So when I've got 2 over u here, that's proportional to the square root of lambda, and so I can do perturbation theory by expanding this factor. And so you can do that, and if you look at the lowest order, I now have a theory which involves zeta, and the quadratic part, at least at tree level, has the same mass in it that I would have got if I'd done the standard symmetry breaking and had a psi in here as well. Okay, if you know about the law concerning field redefinitions, it shouldn't come as too much of a surprise that the particles that are created by this zeta from the symmetrical vacuum now, because I haven't given phi an expectation value, are indistinguishable as far as anything that's is concerned that you might be able to measure from the particles that are created by the conventional operator psi from the asymmetrical background. Okay.
Yeah. In the phi language, you have a Z2 symmetry in the action, but somehow
in
the new language, you have lost it. So there's no way of transforming phi into minus phi anymore.
Yeah.
So somehow the transformation of variables interferes with the symmetry property.
I don't think it interferes. It doesn't interfere with the symmetry. It what it means is that I've only I'm I'm formulating the theory completely in terms of symmetrical operators.
Yeah, but
okay.
Choosing not to ask any questions for that people are
And I can do the same thing when this phi is in the Higgs sector of a gauge theory. And the way it works out there is that I only need to give expectation values to gauge invariant operators. And then I only want to ask gauge invariant questions anyway.
What is the message again? They're saying I'm interested in perturbations around the two vacuums, so I'm going to write down the first line, phi equals to sigma plus phi, the sigma to two vacuums, and develop the second order in psi. Why is it there?
And because in the true vacuum, sigma is equal to zero.
No, but
I don't break the symmetry. That's the point. It just means that I've formulated the theory completely in terms of operators which are invariant under that symmetry.
And change the parity of, say, the input of the state to a different parity of the output of the state, the duration of, say, the symmetric state. But
where does parity come into it?
Internal parity.
Yeah.
So, just
a minute. I mean, there's nothing measurable that I can do to determine what that parity is. I don't think so. I mean, the point is, you, if you think about it in the usual way, you have two candidate vacua, okay, and the overlap between those two vacua goes to zero exponentially with the volume. Right? If I was dealing with a system in a very small volume, I suppose I might have to worry a bit more. Okay, but essentially those two vacua don't interfere. Then anything that I want to do amounts to looking at some symmetrical operator sandwiched between those two vacua. Let me say that again. If I want to calculate S matrix elements, for example, I can calculate an S matrix element in this vacuum. I can calculate an S matrix element in that vacuum. They will be exactly the same. Okay. In the symmetric case, I can't do it.
Yeah. The potential that is flat between the this is found by using the normalization group.
It depends what you mean by the effective potential.
But the
Maxwell construction corresponds to including different domains and doing a spatial average.
Right.
So I'm not doing that.
Right.
Not all effective potentials have to be flat.
Depends on the definition of effective potential.
Yeah, but not the one that all sounds like that, but it doesn't have to.
That's right. I think it's
the Gibbs free energy, right?
Yes, I think it was known more than a few years ago. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's a Gibbs free energy, but you don't have to calculate the Gibbs free energy. You may find some other effective potential more, you know, useful.
Yeah.
And
you should have a definition, but. Yeah, okay. So let me just come back to Rich's point, which is that, I mean, in principle, I am sensitive to domain walls.
Okay, how?
Because if I think about it quantum mechanically, and I think I've got a state like that, okay, in phi, in the phi variable, okay. Well, I might also have a state that looks like that, and I can consider a quantum mechanical superposition of those, okay. Now, I won't be able to tell whether phi is positive or negative in any particular domain, and I claim that there's no way of doing that anyway. Okay, but nevertheless, if I look at something like the energy density, it will go like that.
Well, I guess how do I talk about the kink, the phi kink state,
yeah,
in the C language? I guess I don't quite see how that happens.
I just say that that this is tan squared of x instead of tan of x. Yeah. How else would you do it?
You don't believe it's contained in symmetry.
Sorry?
You don't believe it's contained in symmetry.
I think. Yeah.
Maybe inconvenient.
No.
Yeah.
Well, I think. You see, if I just want to describe what's going on now, it's perfectly good enough, just to say that phi has some expectation value, and I'll choose it to be either that one or that one. Yeah, and I can get the result out. But what I claim is that I can't distinguish that vacuum from that vacuum, or from some superposition of the two of them.
Well, let me say one thing.
Yeah.
Suppose we're being cosmological, we're going to a phase transition.
Yeah.
And let's pretend that the old Kibble mechanism is the way to deal with it. Then you think of having a plus domain here and a minus domain there. And
yeah.
How do I see that in the C formula? I mean, in the C formula, how would I say that now I have defect formation here because it separates a plus and a minus domain? What does that look like in the
No, I don't think you can see it that way. Right. I think you would have to you can't I don't think that you can see it coming out in that way if you see what I mean.
Fluctuations in the C variable.
I think so. Yeah. Yeah.
Well,
that's right. And I mean, you'll look for a configuration in zeta which looks like tan squared rather than a configuration in phi that looks like tan. Now, I'm not saying it's as easy to pick that out.
Okay.
Okay.
Maybe I'm being naive.
Mm-hmm.
Your variable C doesn't range over all parameters.
That's correct. Mm-hmm.
So is there any problem when you're doing functional intervals? Normally you're doing Gaussian.
There is a problem. Which is that the lower limit of integration is not minus infinity, but what it is minus m squared over lambda, something like that. Okay, and so what I claim is that as long as I'm doing perturbation theory, that only gives me corrections that are exponentially small. They won't show up in perturbation theory. Okay, if
in the spontaneous phase.
Yeah.
Perturbation theory
unbound. But I'm not going to use this for the symmetric phase anyway. I can't.
Oh, I thought wasn't part of the motivation to be able to start in one phase and
Yes, it is.
Yeah, but looking at the symmetry broken situation with the negative, with the bare m squared negative, right?
Yeah. What I'm doing at the moment is trying to say what is the state that I might expect to come out.
Okay.
Now, I can't do perturbation theory with this description in the symmetrical face. The reason for that, and it's a problem that I'm left with, which I'm planning to emphasise at the end. The reason is that that then this U is no longer something of order 1 over root lambda, it's order 1. Okay. I'm afraid that's just a problem that I'm stuck with, and I have to see whether anything sensible can be done about that or not. Okay. So that's the state that I might expect to come out. Now let's see how I can try to describe this phase transition dynamically. Okay. So what I've drawn here schematically is my closed time path. On this side, I'm thinking, at least notionally, that there's some probability for phi which looks like that. Okay. There is some not very well defined time that I've called T naught, but I have to pick some time. After which I'm going to imagine that my probability looks something like that. Now, of course, these probabilities are just to guide the eye. I don't know that there's just the one peak or what it looks like. Okay. So in this state here, I have to use my original phi formulation of the theory. Okay. To describe this later state, I have to use my zeta formulation of the theory. There must be some kind of connection so that I could calculate, for example, correlations between what happens there and what happens there. I can't just split the theory in two, and in any case I need initial conditions for what happens here, which have to come from what happened before. Okay. So in addition to the Feynman rules that I got for the phi theory, the Feynman rules that I've got for the zeta theory, there has to be something that connects the two. And took me rather a long time to figure out how to do this. Whether I've been successful or not is something that you can judge, but let me tell you what I've been able to do anyway. So what are the complications? Well, now the expectation value of phi squared depends on time. So when I make this transformation in my action, things work out in a more complicated way, because I got derivatives of this expectation value as well. Okay, so with a view to doing perturbation theory, I've taken out explicitly a factor of 1 over lambda in front of the expectation value, and so this little v that's left over is going now to be I'm going to treat that as order 1. Okay. So I do basically the same thing that I showed you before, notionally I've also folded in my m alpha beta that I told you had decay rates and stuff in before. So my lowest order term is going to be that. Okay. Then I've got terms linear in zeta. Now I've got a zeta 1 and a zeta 2 because I've got fields living on both branches of this contour. Okay, and I have some coefficient here, which before was just this constant term, but now it's got, it was just these two terms, now it's got a V double dot in it, as it turns out. I've got a term which is quadratic, and that has a similar looking thing in front of it. Okay, those are the only thing I'm going to show you explicitly, but there are a whole bunch of other terms. In fact, there are an infinite number of them. Okay. Now, in the same way that I did before, I'm going to want the expectation value of each of these zetas to be zero, which means to lowest order, I'm going to say that this coefficient is equal to zero, and then there will be loop corrections to that. Okay. I'm going to want to define a renormalized mass, which in fact is is this big M squared that I've written here, and then there will be part of my MAB kind of term will have the difference between this M squared and the original M squared in it. In the case, I'm going to do a mastery normalization, which will involve this kind of term here. Yeah, it's a self-consistent.
So that contains the quantum fluctuations
yeah.
in the mass
and so forth.
Yeah. One loop.
Yeah.
One
loop. Yeah. I mean, what this mass is going to be basically the self-energy to whatever order I have the energy to calculate it to.
Okay.
No, it's going to be the local part of the self energy, if you like. Or 15 loops if I've got 150 years to do the calculations. I'm going to have a renormalization condition which says that my counter term in principle cancels off some whole bunch of things, and then how many orders of that I can actually calculate is something else. Yeah.
More general questions, longer questions,
yeah. Okay. We're running behind time already, okay. Okay. So I've got two conditions here, one of which says that my expectation value of zeta is going to be zero. I'm going to get another condition on this counter term for mass renormalization. That's going to give me two things. It's going to give me an equation of motion for my expectation value. It's also going to give me a gap equation that I solve for this renormalized mass. Okay. What you can see is that these two things, in the way I've done things, are interconnected. The reason for that is that my the mass appears in front of phi squared, but that appears in front of zeta. Okay, so the mass renormalization and the equation of motion are sort of interrelated. And you see, I've got two things here, both of which look as if they're going to give me an equation of motion. But what's going to happen is that I take a difference of these things, and that difference gives me the gap equation. Okay. So let's see how I derive these Feynman rules, or at least in outline, because it's rather a messy business. And the essential point is going to be, where do these guys come from? So what I'm going to imagine doing is that I take my generating functional, but I'm going to put in sources for these fields up to my intermediate time t0. I'm going to put in a source for phi, and after t0 and up till some final time, which might as well be infinity, I'm going to put in instead a source for zeta. Okay. And so then on this second half of the contour, I'm going to make this transformation. I seem to have got two different notations because I've put slides together from two different talks, but what I've called V there is what I called U before, I'm afraid. Okay. Right, so basically the way it works then is that we are going to do what we did before. We're going to extract all the interaction parts, including various counter terms, by using these derivatives with respect to the source. That's going to give me a bunch of vertices. What's left over is a z0 that's going to give me the propagators. Okay. Now, of course, when I do this in the usual way, this z0 of j is just a quadratic form in these sources, and that gives me a propagator for each species of field, each species of particle. But here, something a bit different is going to happen, because I've got a functional integral which is integrating over zeta for times later than t naught, and it's integrating over phi for times earlier than t naught.
Includes
yeah.
Includes a Jacobian or doesn't?
It does, yeah. Okay. But these two integrals, of course, are not it's not just a product of two integrals, because at the time t naught, the zeta that's in here has to be the same that's at that's the phi of t naught that's there. Okay. So now there are lots of things that that can go wrong with doing this. I'm not going to spell all of them out. In fact, I can't remember what they all are just at the moment. And also I can't be absolutely confident that I've got them all right. All I can tell you is that I've done the best I can, and I'll tell you what comes out. Okay, so I do the integral over zeta. And that's okay, I just pull out some the sources with the zeta propagator in. There's nothing funny about that. But there is a term left over which involves zeta at t naught, and if you like, that's that comes out from doing an integration by parts. Okay. What this delta is, well, it's zeta now going to be evaluated at time t naught. Here I've got the zeta propagator and the source for zeta. And in between, I've got this little operator that connects the two propagators at early and late times, if you see what I mean. Okay. And so you can see what's going to happen is that this zeta is going to be become phi squared. And this isn't a zero, this is the little vertex that I put in there. So on one side I'm going to have the phi squared propagator in terms of zeta, that's going to be connected to a phi squared propagator in terms of phi. Okay. Okay. So I have this delta in there. That delta then also appears as an addition to the action that I had for phi, and so what I've got inside a time integral, let's say, is a distribution here that's concentrated at t equals t naught. And so then I have to do the phi integral, and I've left out some details, but basically what you get is the following thing. That this z naught now is the first term that I extracted by doing the integral over zeta. Another term that I've extracted, which is j times the phi propagator times j, that's what you might expect. But this propagator now depends on the source for zeta at later times. Okay. And since that depends on the source, it means I've got, at the bottom here, I'm showing you what happens, is that the s naught of phi plus the remainder term from doing the zeta integral looks like this. I've got an extra little term here, which is now, of course, quadratic in phi. It was linear in zeta, so it's quadratic in phi, and it involves this source. And this L tilde has the source and the zeta propagator in it. Okay, and so now when I do this functional integral, well, I invert this, I get a phi propagator, but it has this extra thing in, which has the zeta source in, and because the source of the zeta is in there, well, I also have to keep explicitly the trace of the log of that differential operator, okay, because that depends on the sources. And just at the moment I can't remember where that comes from. This term here comes from the fact that zeta is phi squared plus expectation of phi squared. So one term goes in there and the other one's in there. All right. Okay. So what are the propagators that I get then? Well, I get the propagator for zeta, which is just that. Now for expanding the phi propagator, well, I get just the phi propagator itself, and then plus a whole bunch of terms, well, I've got phi propagators coming in and zeta propagators going out at later times. Okay. From this trace log term, I have things with zeta propagators coming out and phi propagators just evaluated at the intermediate time t naught. Not very much further. I don't think. So I've shown you at least in outline how to get these Feynman rules. Now, what do I need to be able to do perturbation theory? Well, I need those Feynman rules. And I need some extra things that that I have to get self-consistently by using those rules. Okay, the first thing I need is an equation of motion for this V. That comes from, basically from saying that, I had these two conditions that I said were interrelated before. Let me not repeat that. Okay, the equation of motion for V, well, it looks like that when you calculate it to one loop order. Okay. I've written this down in renormalized form because it can be renormalized. And this I1, I've told you what it was somewhere. It's just this one loop bubble, but of course with my more complicated propagator in it, minus some cutoff terms, which makes it finite. Okay. The gap equation looks rather simpler. This m squared of t turns out to be, well, a half this v squared. And then what I can do is to relate it to m hat. And m hat is the pole mass of this theory when you put it in Minkowski space. Okay. So I've got both the gap, the equation of motion, and the gap equation, which are presumably finite. And they're finite provided that my time-dependent occupation numbers decay exponentially at large momenta. I mean, that's a reasonable assumption, though I can't prove it. Okay, so we have those two things. Having that, we need initial conditions for the zeta bit of the theory at this intermediate time t naught. I mean, the initial conditions for the phi theory are given you by the initial density matrix. Okay. And so those initial conditions that you need to apply to the equation of motion I'll get just by requiring that phi squared and d by dt of phi squared should be continuous across the transition when I calculate them in both theories. Okay. Now I've also got these time-dependent occupation numbers which satisfy their own equation inside the propagator, so I need initial conditions from those. I'm going to get that by requiring that the phi squared correlator should be continuous as I go across the transition. At least that's what I want to do in principle. Okay. But there's a problem in all of this that I want to come clean about because I don't know any clean way of solving it. And the problem is that I really have to do two different perturbation theories, and I just don't see any way around doing this. If I want to perturb about a state that looks like this, then the expectation of phi squared is of order 1. If I want to perturb about a state that looks like this, then the expectation of phi squared is order lambda to the minus 1. Okay. As I say, I don't know a good or a clean way of doing it. I can take a pragmatic point of view and say, suppose I'm going to do this calculation numerically. I can do this to some order and calculate what is the expectation of phi squared to that order. I can then do this calculation to some order, and for my initial value of V, I'm going to put in whatever numerical value of V I got out from doing the first one. Okay, and that's the only pragmatic way I can see of doing it. Let me put this in a slightly different way, which is to say the following, that I have an equation of motion for this expectation value, which I can expand systematically in powers of lambda. Okay, I have an initial value V at the intermediate time t naught, which I can also get as a systematic expansion in powers of lambda. And in principle, there's no reason why I shouldn't take this equation and give it this initial condition. Okay? The problem is, though, that if I try to solve this equation with that initial condition, the solution that I get does not itself have a systematic expansion in powers of lambda. And I mean, that's just a problem that you're stuck with if you're going to do perturbation theory. Now, another problem that I'm really quite worried about, and again I don't know anything very much to do about it, is the following. Suppose that I did spontaneous symmetry breaking in the usual way, just in Minkowski space, and I say the expectation of phi is equal to sigma. Well, then I can work out what is the expectation of phi squared in terms of sigma. So in my notation, this v squared over lambda is sigma squared over lambda. Oh, I'm sorry, let's just have a root lambda in. Plus a one loop interval, plus some other stuff. Okay. And I can solve this equation, order by order in lambda, for sigma as a function of v. Okay. Well, this was just doing it in Minkowski space, but that is a one loop integral, and I have an integral which in my... my perturbation theory looks the same when I draw the propagators as lines. This quantity that comes in here is precisely to this order. The quantity that came into my equation of motion. Okay. So that equation of motion can actually be written in a much simpler way, if I define now by I a quantity called sigma. Now, it's not apparently the expectation value of phi, because phi doesn't have an expectation value. The equation of motion looks like this. Okay. The problem is, if I apply my initial conditions, and this is my last transparency now, the initial conditions that I get on V and V dot translate into the statement that sigma is 0 and sigma dot is equal to 0. Okay, and given the equation of motion that I just took off, that means that sigma is equal to 0 at all times. I suppose I can indeed interpret that as being the expectation value of phi, which is equal to 0 at all times. Okay. The problem is, though, that if this is equal to zero at all times, if I write my equation in terms of sigma, I'm not getting anything out of it. And presumably, if I could do all this complicated stuff properly to all orders, what I would find is if I wrote things in terms of sigma, I would just be getting back my original phi theory, but by a very much more complicated route. Which is not what I want to do, because in that version of the theory I'm not going to be able to describe the final state correctly. Okay. Now if I do things systematically and I never think about this sigma, but I just use V, then apparently I have a scheme where I can apply it order by order and get out answers which are going to be at least qualitatively right. But you see, the difference between getting this and getting that basically depends on whether I choose to expand something in powers of lambda or whether I don't, and it's not... I've got something I can go ahead and calculate with, but that doesn't mean I am completely comfortable with it. And I just can't tell you what to do about that, and I don't want to keep you from your lunch anymore, so I'll stop there.